history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, they really are heroes around you. And often, we have no idea how they have directly or indirectly impacted the lives that we lead every day. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories, hold on to them so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And throughout that process, we are educated, we're very entertained, and so often we're inspired by the things that they did then and the lives they've led since. I think we'll be left with that kind of feeling today after spending the next hour with Dick Over, 92 years old, of Golden, Colorado. He's a member of multiple skiing halls of fame, but it all traces back to his time in the 10th Mountain Division during World War II. Dick has done quite a bit to trumpet the history of the 10th Mountain, even though he wasn't able to take part in the division's most famous exploits in the mountains of Italy during World War II. We're going to find out why his service took a different route, and we're also going to learn something I bet you haven't heard before. I don't think I had really understood with relation to the Rocky Mountain ski industry. This might blow your mind. I caught up with Dick in the beautiful home he and his wife Marge built on Lookout Mountain in Golden, Colorado. But we're going to take him back to his native Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And maybe this is a good motivator for the young people listening today, because, Dick, you never would have heard about this brand new idea of ski troopers if you hadn't been a really good student as a teenager.
What happened was in high school, I won a work-study scholarship put out by Westinghouse. They paid my tuition to go to school at night, and I worked in the research laboratories in the daytime.
Huh.
That's where I met this Dr. Trygve Jensen, a good Norwegian who was on the ski patrol. The ski area was Seven Springs, which is just 30 miles outside of Pittsburgh. We would go out and ski on weekends, and Dr. Jensen took me under his wing and got me interested in the National Ski Patrol. So I qualified for that at 17. I was kind of a junior patrolman. So I worked for Dr. Jensen in the labs, and I came in one morning, and he said, Dick, there's a paper on the corner of my desk. I want you to take it home, read it, give it to your dad. You sign it and get your dad to sign it. And I said, what is it? He said, it's your invitation to get into the mountain troops. And I said, what are the mountain troops? He says, they're skiers. He says, it's a brand new army outfit. You're qualified enough as a skier, and I think you'd enjoy it. Well, I thought about it, and I took the paper home, and my dad was in the Marine Corps in World War I, so I had a military background. My dad was not too strict, but I learned a lot about military life. So he reluctantly signed the papers. He wanted me to go into the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps had been very good to him. Even post-war, he had been able to qualify for a loan to get his first home and my first home. So anyway, he signed the papers, and I turned them in. And just before I was ready to leave, the draft caught up with me and said, you report for a medical. So I reported and passed the medical, and I told him, I said, I've enlisted in a thing called the Mountain Troops. He says, have you got any papers? And I said, they should be in the mail. He says, tough. So they put me on a troop train and sent me to Fort Meade, Maryland. The first thing they did at Fort Meade, Maryland, was they put me in a study carrel and put headphones on me. As in the scouting program, I had learned Morse code. Mm-hmm. And I passed that first carrel situation with Morse code with flying colors. And 2 days later, I was on a train to go to Camp Blanding in Florida to join a signal, big signal outfit that they were starting. First, I thought, going to Florida, that's not too bad. But when I got there, I was disappointed. Territory was hot, miserable sand, coral snakes, centipedes, and all kinds of things. And then the crowning thing was that the cadre for this signal outfit was from the south, from Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And the cooks knew nothing but southern food. Collard greens, sweet potatoes, all kinds of southern food, which I was not used to and didn't care for. Well, 4 weeks of basic training, and I get called in one day for the first sergeant. Sonny said, there's papers on the corner of my desk. I've heard this before. And he said, they say you're to go to a Western camp. And he said, no, we'd like to keep you. You're going to be a good signalman. We'd like to keep you. But I have to give you the choice. He said, go to lunch and then come back and give me your decision. Well, go to lunch. That was the key to the whole thing. I thought, I can't do any worse going west than what I've got here.
You mean the food?
The food. The food was just, I didn't care for it. So I went back and I said to him, I've made my decision. I'm going to follow up on those orders that I signed to go to the to a mountain training unit. And he says, son, I'll give you one more chance. He said, I just came from a place there in Camp Carson in Colorado Springs. I know about that camp up there. He said it's full of Polish coal miners and mule skinners. They throw each other through plate glass windows on weekends for entertainment. Now, that's not the kind of a life for a young man like you. And I thought to myself, this guy really wants me to stay.
I guess so.
So I said, Sergeant, I'm going to follow up on my request. So he says, get your stuff in a duffel bag and throw it in a Jeep. Next thing I know, I was on a troop train headed west. And when I got into Colorado Springs and saw the mountains there, I thought, boy, this is where I want to be.
As a lifelong skier, yeah. And I bet, can you imagine how different your life would have been if you had stayed? You would have missed out on quite a bit, wouldn't you?
Yes, I sure would. That decision that I made to join what later became the 10th Mountain Division changed my whole life. I had wanted to be an engineer. I was studying engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. I was working in a laboratory. My whole life was pretty well centered on being an engineer. And when I got through with the 10th, I couldn't get back fast enough and make my change.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. It changed my whole life.
I've got to ask you, as someone who is still skiing at age 92, how young were you when you started? When was the first time you got up on a pair of skis?
I was 10 years old. Somebody gave me a little pair of short skis, just almost as tall as I was. And I lived across the street from a very large cemetery, the largest cemetery in Pittsburgh. There were kids skiing and tobogganing and sled riding in that cemetery. So when people ask me today, where'd you learn to ski? I say, I learned in a graveyard. In those days, skiing was growing in the Midwest. The Norwegians and the Swedes and whatnot were building ski areas primarily with ski jumps.
Mm-hmm.
And on Saturday morning, we'd go to the movies and we would see the Pathé News, and we'd see these fellows skiing, ski jumping.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that looked kind of interesting, and that's what, at that time, there was no slalom. There was downhill racing, and so what we did in that cemetery, what we would do was find a tombstone just about maybe a foot high and pack snow around it, and then we would look up the hill to see where we could find a path down to that stone and hit it and jump. But the key to that whole thing, Paul, you're laughing. We'd look to see if there was an outrun with no more tombstones. And we would find those. And then in the summertime, we'd go along and we'd take pebbles and put it on those tombstones so that we could find them in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. And we had ski runs down fairly steep hills in Pittsburgh. As we got better, we would find another tombstone that was higher, and we'd have that wet powder snow, or wet snow, and pile it up and make a jump out of it.
Uh-huh.
So we got pretty good at ski jumping.
I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who's ski jumped in a cemetery before, so there's a first time for everything.
Yeah. Well,
You mentioned your father being from the Marine Corps, the old breed, as they called them back
then. That's right.
Had he told you many stories from his Marine Corps experiences in World War One?
Yeah, he did. He was in the Philippines, and he was in France. He was there at the end of the war, and they kept the Marines on what he called cleanup duty. But he got to travel sometime, and my dad took a lot of pictures. He had a little folding Kodak camera, and he took a lot of pictures. He had three big photographic albums, and I had all of those, and I grew up with those pictures on my lap. And so I say I had a military legacy, and I was very proud of my dad. He was quite an athlete. He grew up in a little town outside of Pittsburgh called Kane, Pennsylvania. He became captain of the basketball team. He played tennis, and he played baseball. So we went into the Marine Corps with four or five of his buddies from that little surrounding area, and they stayed together. And after the war, they would all gather in the fall and go hunting together. So I grew up with that legacy, and I was very proud of my dad. He taught me to swim at the YMCA. During World War One, the YMCA was like the USO is today. When he came out, he joined the YMCA, and the first thing he did was teach myself and my brother to swim. He played basketball, became the captain of a basketball team for the YMCA, and they were so good. They played Duquesne University, Pittsburgh, Springfield, and some more, and just walloped the socks off of these college teams. These guys had lived together and played together, and so they had a camaraderie that I picked up, and I carried that on to this day, the camaraderie that we have. That's why I'm still doing things like this morning. I gave a talk. There were two of us who were still living and still skiing some. And it so happens that our birthdays are the same day,
how about
March
that?
22nd. Huh. He was born a little before me, and so he let it be known that to the group we talked to this morning that he was my elder. And he was older. He became a hero with a Silver Star. He personally attacked a German machine gun nest, threw a grenade, and killed the guys. And then he took the machine gun, and the other Germans that were coming, he killed a lot of them, and for that he got the Silver Star.
Wow. What's his name?
Hugh Evans.
And I'm sure there are a lot of 10th Mountain veterans that you could tell me some stories about, because you're so involved with them. Getting back to your father, and you saying, you know, that how much you looked up to him, and I get the sense that you always had a feeling you were going to be in the service at some point, one way or the other.
Yeah.
But what do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Everybody seems to remember something about that day.
I can tell you exactly where it was. My first job in high school, a friend of my dad's, was the manager of the largest theater in that area, and he gave me a job as an usher at that theater. On December 7th, I was an usher standing at the head of an aisle, the center aisle. There were big theater, had two big organs, 3,500 seats in that floor.
What was it called?
The Enright Theater.
The Enright Theater, all right.
And on December 7th, I was standing at the head of the aisle, and the chief of service came over and he said, "We've just been bombed in Pearl Harbor." They had the radio on.
Did you guys interrupt the film to make that announcement to the folks in the theater or no?
They did at the end of the film.
That had to be something to witness, to watch that big of a crowd react to that kind of news.
Well, this was a Sunday morning, and there weren't too many people in the theater on Sunday morning.
They're all at church.
Yeah. So that's my story about the beginning of the war.
Everybody has a December 7th story.
Yeah,
it's always
right.
Fascinating to hear. Yeah. And you've already shared with us how you enlisted and wanted to be in the mountain troops, ended up, we followed your path all the way back to where you actually were with these mountain troops. And this has never happened before in American history. You guys were real trailblazers. This is a first-time thing.
That's right.
Usually when that's the case, when you're doing something that no one else has done before, there are some curveballs or some hiccups or some mistakes that happen along the way. Do you remember anything like that?
Oh, yeah, I can tell you what resulted from I went through that early training. To be honest, I got a little bit sick and tired of being an infantryman. In my early days, I had joined the scouting movement, and the reason for it was my dad was in the Marine Corps. I grew up with a book that I still have. The Marine Corps had a thing, Blue Jackets Manual. Mm-hmm. And the Marine Corps was the fighting unit of the Navy. So that Blue Jackets Manual had a lot of Navy because they transported the Marines
right
wherever they needed them. So I grew up with a lot of interest in the naval things. My buddies were all building model airplanes, you know. I was building ship models.
Mm.
So I learned a lot about through that Blue Jackets Manual. And so I joined the Sea Scouts. For 3 summers. We went as a group to Chesapeake Bay and spent 10 days on a 3-masted schooner.
Wow.
So we learned a lot.
Yeah.
And with my interest in my dad and learning, I had originally thought maybe I'd be in the Navy until this mountain unit came up and I was a skier.
Right.
So I followed that path instead of going to the Navy. Well, I looked one Sunday when I was in the infantry. I looked down the way and I saw some vehicles running around with antennas on them. And they had just started a signal corps unit for the division.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked down to the signal company and I walked in and said to the lieutenant, I said, "Lieutenant, I learned a lot about Morse code and things like that. Are you recruiting for signalmen?" And he said, "Yeah, we're looking for radio operators." So he interviewed me a little bit. 3 days later, I was transferred from the infantry into the signal company. I got to be a driver of a radio vehicle, a military vehicle at that time, were Weasels. If you look over at this picture over here, you'll see me sitting in a sitting in a Weasel.
And I have that photo and quite a few others posted for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page as well as hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our first break now, but when we come back, we're going to follow the rest of Dick's World War II journey and learn about the impact of the 10th Mountain Division that has gone far beyond World War II and far beyond the military. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.